Welcome back to Crackin' Backs, your sanctuary for uncovering the latest frontiers in medicine. Today, we are joined by an extraordinary guest, Dr. Scott Scherer, a stalwart in the realm of internal and hyperbaric oxygen medicine. With prestigious academic accolades from UCLA and the University of Maryland, he is not just a hyperbaric oxygen therapy physician, but an innovator who's leading the charge in using an integrative approach to hyperbaric care. Dr. Scherer's particular expertise lies in using HBOT for traumatic brain injury and stroke, a topic he's lectured on from coast to coast. Not just content in pushing the boundaries of traditional medicine, Dr. Scherer is also the chief operating officer of Troscriptions, where he offers groundbreaking troches or methylene blue lozenges. A known authority on the use of methylene blue for brain optimization and its interaction with light. His insights are enlightening as they are intriguing. So buckle up as we delve into the profound depths of hyperbaric medicine and beyond with Dr. Scott Scherer.
Dr. Scherer, or do you go by Dr. Scott? You know, it doesn't really, I guess it's all good. Thank you for being on the show. We're honored to have you. And when I asked Brian McKenzie, who's a mutual friend, who he thought would be on the show, he didn't even hesitate. He goes, "You got to get Dr. Scott on your show. He's all, you know, he's fantastic when it comes to HBOT, or for those listening, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and everything that has to do with it. A lot of people think of hyperbaric chambers only for divers and the bends. Mm-hmm. And you've kind of exploded that, and you broke out of this mold. And so can you explain how you find this technology applicable for beyond the diver and how you got into it?
Mm. Yeah, well, Brian's a great guy. I'm glad you guys have had him on the podcast and chat a lot. He and I get very deep into the weeds when it comes to respiratory physiology and oxygen and the waste product that is carbon dioxide. I said that on purpose for Brian. He loves it when people call carbon dioxide a waste product. So there you go, Brian, that's for you. And so I've been involved in the world of hyperbaric medicine now for over 10 years. I was a medical director of a facility in San Francisco. It's kind of my first true hyperbaric gig in 2013. And now it's been over 10 years since that happened. And I've really enjoyed learning about this physiology, the physiology of hyperbaric therapy, the process, the history. I mean, there's so much here to kind of dig into. I think for most people listening, the basic idea here is that these are wound healing chambers. These are optimizing chambers. These accelerate your goals kind of chamber. Because what happens here is that we're getting more oxygen into the body. It's full stop. And as a result of that, when you get more oxygen in the body, you're going to do about four or five things, and you're going to do them in a significant way. But it depends on obviously where you're starting, where you want to go, how acute the issue, how chronic the issue is. But in general, you're doing a couple of things. Obviously you're reversing low oxygen states. So you're reversing hypoxia. And by doing that, if you have an acute issue, like an acute trauma, more significantly like a stroke or a traumatic brain injury or a spinal cord injury or a heart attack or a limb trauma, if you can get oxygen to this tissue at the time where it's compromised, you can potentially save a lot of this tissue from dying. Over the long term, when you can get oxygen into the tissue, you can create new blood vessels in the area that's been damaged or deteriorated or inflamed or things like that. And you can sustain that tissue over a long period of time. So number one, we're reversing low oxygen state. The second thing we're doing is decreasing inflammation. We do this immediately when you go into a hyperbaric environment. And you also decrease inflammation over the long term. Sorry about that, guys. I was going to just turn that off. That's kind of annoying. And I thought I'd decrease all my notifications, but I guess not. The second thing you're doing is decreasing inflammation. You're doing that immediately when you go into the chamber. And then over the long term, you're actually down-regulating the ways the body enhances inflammation or has a hard time dealing with inflammation over that long period of time. And inflammation and swelling go together. You can decrease inflammation, you decrease swelling. And this is really important. Obviously, if you have an acute trauma, again, when you have swelling, and swelling can cause damage to tissue. Third thing we're doing is increasing stem cell release. Stem cells are the baby cells in the body that can make any new cell in the body that's required. If you have an injury, if you have trauma, if you have degeneration, et cetera. So you're decreasing hypoxia, reversing hypoxia, you're decreasing inflammation and swelling, you're increasing stem cell release. Next thing you're doing is also you're killing bugs that do not like high oxygen environments. So by doing that, this is used very much in trauma settings, again, also in facilities that treat severe infections like necrotizing fasciitis or something like that, which is a flesh-eating type of bacteria. That's pretty nasty, but hyperbaric therapy can reverse a lot of that and can prevent a lot of the damage that can happen from that. We also, in the chamber, increase flow, so increase blood flow into tissues, and we also decrease lymphatic flow out of tissues by creating something called structured water or easy water around blood vessels that helps with the flow in and out of tissue. So to sum up, the physiology is what I've described. You're getting more oxygen in circulation. You're getting more pressure in the body too, which we can talk about. But in essence, you're reversing hypoxia, decreasing inflammation and swelling. You're killing bugs. You're increasing stem cell release and you're increasing flow.
There you go.
That's great. I want to know what the skeptics say to you and what do you commonly hear? I'm not one of them, but we see a lot of hyperbaric chambers used in sports performance, sure, which is what Dr. Terry and I are really very much involved in. But, you know, you got, you know, a variety of types of chambers. But what are the skeptics saying to you?
Well, I think it really depends on the reason why they're being skeptical. I think there's a couple different frames of reference here. I think the main one would be in the studies that have been performed in hyperbaric environments. The main challenge that you have in performing a study in a hyperbaric chamber is that, in essence, what you want to do for most studies is have a placebo-controlled trial where you have somebody that does not get a therapy or a treatment, and then somebody that does, and you compare them in a similar demographic group, and you see if there's a difference between the two. The problem with any surgery or any procedure is that it's difficult to do that when there's actually a procedure involved. So, for example, they do this in people that get arthroscopic surgery for a meniscal tear. We used to think that people needed to get these things repaired or they would have significant difficulty over the long term. They get arthritis, they would have more deformity, they'd have more dysfunction. But they've done these studies over the years now. They do sham treatments where somebody gets the meniscal repair and then somebody just gets a surgical incision, but they don't do anything, right? So that's the sham surgery. And they found over the years that for most people that have meniscal tears, and arthroscopic surgeries are not really worth the time or the effort, they actually increase your risk of getting arthritis over the short term, as opposed to just doing PT, working and doing physiologic kinds of things and range of motion, et cetera. So the same thing kind of applies in hyperbaric therapy. The idea would be you're trying to compare somebody that goes into a hyperbaric chamber and gets treatment versus somebody that doesn't go, that also gets into a hyperbaric chamber, but doesn't get treatment. Mm-hmm. That's very, very difficult to do. And that goes along with the problem, I'll say in quotes, with pressure. The idea in a hyperbaric environment that you're increasing the amount of oxygen in circulation, but you're doing that by increasing the amount of atmospheric pressure that the body is, and the lungs specifically, are feeling. So we simulate the pressure you feel under a certain amount of seawater. And that water is heavy, and that heaviness drives more oxygen in circulation. So oftentimes, what they'll do in a hyperbaric study is that they'll compare two levels of hyperbaric pressure. One, a mild level that they call the sham treatment, and then one, a more significant level that they call the treatment. The problem, though, is in the sham treatments, oftentimes they're giving a little bit of pressure, and as a result of that, they are changing physiology. We know that mild amounts of pressure will increase the amount of oxygen in circulation, even if you're not giving oxygen in a face mask or some other way. So the challenge is that the studies are hard to do, and also they're expensive to do. And in addition, there's no patented drug at the end of the rainbow, because oxygen is not something you can patent. Okay. So I think that's the first major controversy, and that very easy for me to discuss with people that have any interest in discussing this. We can talk about placebo-controlled trials. We can talk about shams, all this stuff I just glanced over pretty quickly over there. The second thing I think is that there are different types of chambers. And this is what you're alluding to, Spencer, is that you have mild units, units that go to a very mild amount of hyperbaric pressure and oxygen, and you have medical grade units that can go very, very deep. And the challenge within that spectrum is that some things will respond very, very well at mild pressures, but other things won't. And some things will respond very, very well at deep pressures, but they won't respond very well at mild pressures. So it can go both ways. So the mild units don't have as much studies. They don't have as many studies to talk about how they're, how they can be beneficial. They don't have as many, there's just not as many safety studies. There's a lot of things that are sort of limited on the mild side, but we do know, looking at all the data in the literature, that the mild units that typically go between 1.3 and 1.5 atmospheres, which is about 12 to 15 feet of seawater equivalent in pressure, can do a really good job in optimizing neurocognitive physiology, and probably good also for day-to-day operations like jet lag and exercise recovery and overall sort of milder types of things. Whereas the deeper chambers have more of the research behind them. The 2-atmosphere pressure, which is the equivalent of 33 feet of seawater, is the most studied pressure. And as a result of this, this is where most of the literature and most of the work that I do is kind of based on this pressure, especially when you're coming to systemic or outside the central nervous system indications.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah, there. So the measurement is atmospheres, right? The portable ones are like 1 atmosphere, and then the ones that you probably work with are 2, or are there?
So 1 atmosphere,
the maximum 3 atmosphere.
Yeah, 1 atmosphere is the equivalent of 0 feet of seawater. So 1 atmosphere is sea level, and then you have 1.3 to 1.5, which are the mild units, and that's typically that's about 12 to 15 feet of seawater. And then you have the medical grade units that can go from anywhere between 1.3 to 3.0 typically. And then those are called monoplace chambers. Those are single occupancy chambers. And you have what are called multiplace chambers. Those can go up to 6 or 7 or 8 ATA, 8 times 33, if you want to do the math. And the reason why they have those chambers is what Terry was asking, Dr. Terry was mentioning before, which was related to diving. Because if you have a diving injury, you have to be pressurized to the level of which the diving injury happened. And so if you had a diving injury at 125 feet of seawater, you need to go into a chamber that can go to 125 feet of seawater. Okay. This is how hyperbaric therapy was developed, you know, way back when. But I think you make a really good point, and I think it's important just to kind of emphasize that pressure is the key to hyperbaric therapy. You can't just put a face mask on your face and think you're going to get more oxygen in circulation. You have red blood cells that typically carry oxygen. There's only a certain amount of red blood cells you have in your body. Most of us are doing very well right now, saturating those red blood cells. If anybody's put a pulse ox on their finger, it really will often be somewhere between 96 and 100% measured. That means that 96 to 100% of the sites on your red blood cells, after they leave the lungs, are saturated with oxygen, okay? And that's 21% oxygen in the air that you're breathing at sea level. Me here in Colorado, it's 16% oxygen. But what I do here, a way that you can kind of compensate for having less oxygen around is by increasing the number of red blood cells you have in circulation. So you can do this legally. You can come to Colorado. You can come train here as all the endurance guys do. Or you can do this illegally. By taking a drug called Epogen, which increases the number of red blood cells, like the one ball wonder, Lance Armstrong, right? I know you guys may know Lance. I think Brian does. Yeah. So that's what these guys do. They take EPO, so they increase their red blood cell number. Or you can actually give yourself a red blood cell transfusion right before a race. And I'm sure you've heard of this as well. Mm-hmm. This is going to increase your oxygen carrying capacity because you're increasing the number of red blood cells you have in circulation. The other way to do this, though, is by going into a hyperbaric environment, which is going to saturate the liquid of your bloodstream or the plasma itself. The way that happens is that when you get pressure on a vessel and on your lungs, that pressure is going to change your physiology and drive oxygen directly into the plasma or the liquid of your bloodstream. So you can get up to 1,200% more oxygen in circulation, but it wouldn't show up on your pulse ox. This is something that Brian and I talk about a lot when you're talking about hypoxic training and you're talking about how to measure the difference inside of a hyperbaric environment versus hypoxia and things like that. It's very difficult to do that because you can only measure the red blood cell saturation of oxygen easily. You can't measure the plasma oxygen saturation unless you do like an ABG or on somebody, which is not an easy thing to do. So pressure is key. Hyperbaric therapy doesn't work without pressure. Any type of pressure, any amount of pressure starts changing your physiology, increasing the amount of oxygen that's going to go in circulation, increasing the amount of energy that you're going to make. Because why do we care about oxygen anyway? The more oxygen that we have, the more energy that you're going to make, and the more products of energy metabolism that you're going to make that help with signaling. And these are called reactive oxygen species.
Mm. You obviously have been doing this for a long time because you're answering a lot of the questions that I keep wanting to come up with, right? Or wanting to ask you. The one with, why can't you just wear an oxygen mask, you know, but obviously it's about the pressure. Right. So that was fantastic. Thanks for answering that. Now, as you may know, I mean, I'm here in South Florida. The Keys was one of the locations, the Florida Keys, that had one of the first hyperbaric chambers. You know, it was a big steel, you know, very rugged looking chamber with a little porthole. And that was for when you referred to diving injuries, you were referring to, is it still called the bends?
It is.
The people's, you know.
Decompression illness, okay. Or the bends, yeah.
Decompression illness, right? So I remember growing up hearing about this chamber. So it's been around for a long time. Now, let me ask you, concussions are, you know, I worked in the NFL for many years, and I'm seeing a lot of the guys that I used to treat now for, you know, obviously the suspect of old concussion, mm-hmm. the plaquing and the tau proteins and everything. There was an article written not too long ago about Joe Namath, a famous quarterback that is obviously in his like 70s now. And up in Jacksonville, Florida, they were doing hyperbaric chamber on a very, very frequent basis. And they were finding that there was regenerative changes to the nervous system and the brain. Can you elaborate on some of the, you know, traumatic brain injury and whiplashes that, you know, where hyperbaric helps?
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, Joe's been pretty outspoken about his trajectory where he was doing very poorly for quite some time, mentally, cognitively, and then how hyperbaric therapy really was the answer for him in how he was able to regenerate his brain. And what was nice about Joe's process, and this is something that's happening more in the hyperbaric literature, is that it's not just how you feel. It's about also looking at objective types of technology and imaging to kind of see that progression and say, hey, look, I don't just feel better. Look at my brain and look how it's working better now too. And this is what are called functional types of images. These are imaging studies that are done. So there's functional MRI, something called DTI, which is another type of MRI that looks at the blood flow, the metabolism of the nerves and the brain and blood and overall the vascular density and how these things change over the time. And so what Joe did in the work up in Northern Florida, as you were mentioning, was do a whole battery of hyperbaric therapy and then watch the brain changes over these periods of time periodically and seeing how his brain was changing and then doing other types of subjective measures, cognitive scoring, et cetera. And this has been repeated in more study designs. The Israelis probably have the largest hyperbaric program in the world over in Tel Aviv, Israel. And now they're over in retirement community in Florida, the villages, as you guys probably know, calling themselves the Aviv clinics. And they have a place also, I think, in Dubai as well now, where they do a whole battery of testing for people beforehand, and they do hyperbaric therapy, and then they do a battery of testing afterwards. They look at multiple different types of metrics and things like that. But the key here really is that you have the ability in a hyperbaric chamber to regenerate tissue. You have regenerating the body, the brain, and you can see this in real time. You can look at new blood vessels forming in the brain. You can see the new pathways where nerves are firing when you're looking at EEGs and QEGs on neurofeedback. You can see this stuff. And over the many years that I've been doing this, it's quite evident in somebody that's gotten hyperbaric therapy and then somebody that hasn't. And I've worked with neurofeedback providers, for example, that do a lot of QEEGs in their practice, and they can tell somebody that's been getting hyperbaric therapy and then somebody that hasn't, and they're getting the same treatment on the neurofeedback side, but seeing massive differences on the, because of doing hyperbaric therapy. It all comes down to that same physiologic shifts, as I was describing before, when we're getting new blood vessels and tissue, when we're decreasing inflammation, when you're getting stem cells released, when you're optimizing tissue healing, you're going to see all these things occur, not only in the subjective side, but also on the objective side as well.
Interesting. In retrospect, just for our listeners, you mentioned a really cool diagnostic tool that not many people, even doctors, know about, diffuse tensor imaging, which you said referenced to DTI. Yes. Dr. Terry, if you have not seen a DTI, it is it's fascinating because it actually shows where broken axons, and it's illuminated, it's colorized if you want, and showing repair to those it's a type of MRI that has like a different program to it. It's really, really, really neat.
Yeah. So, functional MRI is probably the better of the two technologies because it doesn't require contrast, but DTI is great. Yeah. And when I was in Israel back in 2018, they took me through their whole program and I got a functional MRI and I did all their cognitive testing and things like that. So it's super cool. And I think, we know the burden of traumatic brain injury. We know the burden of concussion. We know how terrible these long-term side effects can be, obviously for these NFL athletes, but even for regular people that are playing sports as kids and heading the ball and in collegiate sports and things like that. Not only does it seem to be probably significantly helpful for people that have these injuries, but not even if they don't even have overt injuries, if it's like the sort of like subconcussive kinds of things, there likely is a significant benefit there. And there's even some data, although it's in animals, that even pre-treating with hyperbaric therapy may be very beneficial in people that are at high risk for getting concussion as well.
Oh, fantastic. Let me ask you about methylene blue lozenges that you advocate. Can you share? I think that's nootropics are becoming very popular these days. Can you share some of your findings?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the context for people is that my clinical practice is it's a spectrum of things that I do. The first thing that I do with most people is I focus on foundational biology in the sense of how well can you make energy, looking at vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and cofactors, gut health, hormones, and things like that. So that's the foundation of what I do typically. What I found over the years, guys, is that if you have an acute issue, hyperbaric therapy is very, very helpful at revving up the process, accelerating the process of healing. It's going to increase the ability to just heal tissue faster. Okay. However, if you have a longstanding injury, if you have a chronic issue, oftentimes getting into a hyperbaric chamber right away is not the right thing to do because the body is already under significant stress. It's been under stress for a period of time. There could be vitamin, mineral, and other kinds of deficiencies. You may not be able to make energy well. And if you go into a hyperbaric chamber and you're making energy poorly, you are going to have a challenge making energy when you get more oxygen in circulation. Okay. So as a result of that, what I've developed over the years is a clinical practice that really looks at basic foundational types of technology, foundational types of testing to really be able to assess people from the ground up before they go into a hyperbaric chamber. Okay. So this is something it's called health optimization medicine in practice. It's something that I've been doing for a while. It's also a nonprofit organization that's training doctors and practitioners like me. Okay. So oftentimes people come to me and they'll say to me, "Hey, Dr. Scott, I want to get into a hyperbaric chamber because I have, a post-concussive syndrome, let's say, right? And I've had symptoms for 6 months. I think hyperbaric therapy can be helpful for you, but I don't think it's the first step in your journey. The first step in your journey is to truly look at these foundational principles first. And then once these things are addressed, or at least starting to address, then we can think about getting you into a hyperbaric environment. Because I've gotten burned over the years trying to get people in too quickly, but they can't make energy effectively. And if you can't make energy effectively, and I give you a whole bunch more oxygen, there's a good chance you're not going to feel very good. Okay. And so what I've developed over the years is what I would call an integrative approach. The integrative approach starts with the foundational piece here. And then I add on to that integrative approach tools, technologies, and practices, supplements included, that will help along the process. Some of them are dialed in specifically with data as I've been describing. So I know if you can't make energy well, if you don't have the ability to detox very well, like if you're making energy, of course, you also have to be able to balance out the products of energy metabolism, which include reactive oxygen species, for example. This is like, are you antioxidant deficient, basically? So if I do that all sort of data driven, but then I also add in various types of supplements and tools and technologies and practices. I send them to Brian, for example, and we do parasympathetic training and looking at how breath work can significantly optimize your hyperbaric experience, but also your stress response, obviously. I guess the short story is I'm a smokescreen. I talk about hyperbaric therapy till my ears bleed, but on podcasts, but for the most part, when I talk to patients, 85% of what I talk about has nothing to do with hyperbaric therapy. because everything else is almost more important because, right. And because the hyperbaric therapy is the easy part. You just go into a chamber and relax. Right. But it's all the other stuff. And methylene blue is one of those things that I talk about a lot because it's a compound that's been around a long, long time. We know it's very, very safe. We know it has a significant profile where it not only does it help with increasing energy production, but it also has the ability to balance out reactive oxygen species or oxidative stress. So it has the ability to help. So when you, like I said, when you make energy, you make products of energy metabolism. These include reactive oxygen species, carbon dioxide, and water. Okay. The body has to be able to balance that out. Or be able to shift as a result of those and maintain energy production or maintain antioxidant reserve and things like that. So what methylene blue is able to do is it helps with energy production and it also helps with antioxidant reserve. In addition, it also helps because it has the ability to work with mitochondria that aren't working that well in the sense that, you know, a lot of us these days have mitochondrial dysfunction. If you have chronic inflammation, if you have a chronic condition, if you have a chronic infection, if you have a post-infectious type of syndrome, maybe something like long COVID, for example, you do have mitochondrial dysfunction. And so adding something like methylene blue to the mix can be extremely effective and help supporting the system, you know, while you're doing the extra work or the more work of optimizing overall. So sorry, long answer to your methylene blue question.
But no, context. I love it. Now what baselines do you establish? Are they lab work? Are they physical exam before you do the hyperbaric and to determine the blood level?
Right. It's a great question. I think what I've really kind of emphasized through the years of doing this is that whether it's an acute issue or a chronic issue, like basic stuff is essential, like in the sense that like getting basic blood work to make sure that you're not anemic, that you're not iron deficient, that your thyroid's not is working, or like basic stuff is really important no matter if it's an acute issue or a chronic issue. Okay. But when it comes to more chronic issues, that's where I like to get a little bit more in depth if I can with people and look at like foundational biomarkers. This is in a field that's called metabolomics, is the world that I live in. Metabolomics is the study of the real-time workings of your cells. How well, as I was describing before, how well are you making energy? How well are you utilizing your macronutrients to break down into the energy cycles? How well are you detoxifying? Do you have evidence of heavy metals or mineral deficiencies or neurotransmitter imbalances? Is your gut toxic? Because if you have a leaky gut, you're not absorbing your vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, and you're also likely more inflamed and your immune system might be screwed up and your brain can't heal itself and your blood-brain barrier is all screwed up. And so like these are things that I've just found over the years, if you can address them earlier in the process. I've gotten disinvited, guys, from hyperbaric conferences because my typical stick here is don't put them in the chamber. don't put them in the chamber yet. You know, wait until you have more of a sense of what's going on under the hood if it's not an acute issue. And so these, I look at maybe, if I have the option for people, my preference is to look at between, 2 to 500 biomarkers, and then using that information, create a holistic plan for people that includes addressing those biomarkers, but not just that, looking at, diet, lifestyle, looking at anything from sunlight exposure to sleep, to, the timing of the food, to looking at blood sugar regulation. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive program that I take people through. Not everybody can do that. And I get that. But I think that if you can't do that, at least doing the basics is extremely important. Getting basic blood work done is I've had a couple of people over the years that, and this happened early on in my career, is that we do a whole bunch of hyperbaric therapy. They wouldn't get better. And then I'd find out later that they were iron deficient, and then they got iron and they felt better. Right. Something very simple like that. You're just like, well, this is ridiculous. Everybody just needs to get basic stuff done before they go into a hyperbaric chamber.
Okay. So that, but okay. I was impressed with your conversation about hyperbarics, but now I'm extra impressed because I know nobody that does all the pre-hyperbaric work to really identify what's going on with their system. So that's fantastic. As far as for athletic performance, obviously these are people that are in relatively great shape, but wanting to create a more peak performance experience. And then I would love to know what your favorite most difficult patient is. So that's two questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think in the realm of peak performance and the athletic sphere in general, I mean, I work with a decent amount of people in this world, and most of them are not as well optimized as you would imagine. Most of them are usually running on fumes because they're overtraining, as you probably know. Right. And so it's really important to do a lot of these kinds of things with them, is looking at basic physiology, looking at energy production, detoxification pathways, gut health, things like that, because you can make a huge difference in these people. And that's really all they need, is 1 or 2 or 5% to see the major differences in their race times and their performance as well. And then you can add on things like methylene blue, which are great to help with aerobic capacity, because you get more oxygen utilization for longer because you have methylene blue around. And then you can use things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy in various types of contexts. You can use it in a sort of pre-treatment or pre-training idea, because there's actually some pretty good studies on increasing VO2 max with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So increasing your minute-to-minute utilization of oxygen. This is probably because of increased vascular density, the density of blood vessels around your heart specifically. And there's some data that's come out of Israel again. They haven't published a lot of this, but there's some on how it improves markers of ventricular function, of ejection fraction, even in people with normal ejection fractions, normal heart function. And this is also happening with increasing VO2, but these are longer protocols. You know, one thing we haven't mentioned, and a good sort of fulcrum for people, is that if you have an acute issue in a hyperbaric chamber and you want to get better, you're talking maybe as little as one treatment, maybe 5, maybe 10, typically done in a row, 5 days a week with the weekends off, sometimes 6 days a week, as opposed to a chronic issue where it's been going on a long period of time, where you're really trying to shift physiology and not just enhance the body's ability to heal itself. When you're shifting physiology, what you're doing is actually shifting what's called epigenetics, your expression of various genes in your DNA. And that's what hyperbaric therapy is doing, really. That takes longer. These protocols are typically at minimum 20 sessions, can be as many as 40, 60, sometimes up to 120 or more. And Joe Namath before has done over 120 hyperbaric sessions. And these are done 5 days a week, typically, for a period of time. Now, not always all of them in a row, 120. Like, typically we do take breaks with people after about 40 or 60 sessions. And there's various other types of ways to do this. But in essence, you're not looking at just a couple hyperbaric sessions if you have a chronic issue. You're talking about multiple sessions in a row for chronic issues. And so when you, or and in the chronic condition world, I would also say long-term goals. So if you have an athlete or you have a human, you know, like you or I, that want to increase VO2 max, we're not going to see a sustained increase in VO2 max probably until about treatment 20 to 30 in a hyperbaric chamber. Where what I mean by sustained is that when you finish or stop hyperbaric therapy, you're still going to see a benefit for some period of time afterwards. How long that period of time is depends on the person, depends on their foundational stuff, as I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. And if you have a better foundation, you need less of this, less hyperbaric therapy to see the long-term benefits. And then, of course, if you're using other tools and technologies and practices and things like that, you're going to see even more of a benefit. But the minimum really is about 20 or so to see a sustained benefit in some of these physiologic markers. So you have in athletes, you can do the VO2 max thing ahead of time. So you have that. So while they're training, but you can also use periodic hyperbaric therapy for muscle recovery, for sleep optimization, because, you know, people will sleep better if they've done hyperbaric therapy after a big training session, because they're going to shift their physiology. They're going to help recover faster. So I use it for anything from athletes that are, you know, flying a lot for jet lag. I use it for muscle recovery. I use it for injury recovery. I use it for cognitive optimization in athletes as well that are doing a lot of training. One of the things, I mean, there's so many pieces of all this, right? But like in a hyperbaric environment, your multitasking capacity goes up. So you can do, I have guys and ladies that'll watch game tape in their chambers because that's when they're going to be able to actually infuse it into their brains and stick it there easier and faster, as opposed to like just flipping around on their phone or something like that instead. So,
and that's going two atmospheres in the more industrial strength hyperbarics, not the, you know, the portable, so not necessarily the portable.
The answer one. Is that ideally, yes, they have a two atmosphere chamber that they can use, but I can do a lot for people in the 1.3 to 1.5 range as well, especially for the day-to-day optimization, recovery, cognitive side of things. When it comes to VO2 max changes, I don't think that's going to, I may happen in a mild unit, but it probably won't, it definitely won't happen to the degree that'll happen in a deep chamber. And yeah, people have to be careful because there's a lot of people that hawk the soft chambers that will say that the soft chambers can do the exact same thing as the hard chambers. You just have to do more treatment. But that, like in a word, that's just bullshit, you know, because there's no evidence of that at all. You know? Yeah. When you're getting into a hyperbaric environment and you're going to two atmospheres, you're going to get a certain amount of oxygen tension that you can never match at 1.3 in the chamber. Yeah. So just think about how far oxygen can diffuse out of a blood vessel at two atmospheres versus 1.3. It's going to be like night and day. So that's not to say you can't get benefits, but it's not the same.
You know, going back a little bit, we live in the world of a pharmaceutical world. You know, you take a pill and the people want instant results, you know? So, you know, people listening, I want to make sure we go back a little bit that, oh, I want to increase my brain capacity. I'm going to take a methyl blue lozenger and it's not supervised, you know, or I'm going to take this, or I'm going to hop in the hyperbaric chamber. I have a friend that has a steel chamber. I'm going to hop in that. You know, I can throw a rock at Amgen. And so I live right next to EPO land, you know. So people always want to take that quick pill or that quick thing. They don't want to put in the work. How do you break people from this pharmaceutical brain mindset? And when you want to break down their body and look at it, how do you do that?
Well, I think what I do is I try to understand the sort of the effectiveness of what I'm trying to kind of elicit here is that there's a spectrum of things that people can do that are going to be very safe versus potentially harmful. Right. And then try to get people to understand the spectrum and kind of where they're going to start. Like, certainly I don't want somebody going over to a friend's house and going into their steel chamber and having no clue what they're doing. Because people do have these things in their homes, in their garages. I mean, some people make them themselves. It's kind of crazy what engineers will do. And so you don't know what you're getting. You don't know why you're doing it. So I think the real thing to have people understand is like, why are they doing what they're doing? Okay. And then trying to take the next step is the thing that I'm doing extremely safe, or are there potential dangers of it? And because in general, like most of us, it's just the human animal. We want quick fixes to things. We don't realize that it took us 45 years to feel this way, and we can't expect to feel better tomorrow. I mean, I don't know if you guys know, my father's a chiropractor as well. And he's been a chiropractor for 40 years on Long Island. And so I grew up in the realm of understanding that the body can heal itself, but it's not like it's going to be like magic and it's going to be tomorrow. Right. It takes time. It takes effort, and it takes supervision, and it takes people helping you along the way. The problem with what we have now is that there's so much information that everybody thinks that they're their own expert. They just have to go to Dr. Google and they know exactly what's wrong with them.
Right.
And so I have to, and so I mean, not to say that it's wrong to research and kind of figure things out, but most of us really do benefit from having some sort of coach or quarterback that at least has an expertise in some of the stuff that you're interested in. And then hopefully knowing what they don't know, and they can refer you out to other people. I mean, with methylene blue, for example, it's a very safe compound. It could be used almost across the board at low doses. We're talking about low dose, about 8 to 16 milligrams on a regular basis. is not going to hurt most people. It could be very beneficial. And I think the downsides are pretty low overall. I think that having your own doing your own research is really important, making sure, obviously, if you have medical conditions, that there's no contraindications and things like that. But something like hyperbaric therapy is sort of the other end of, not the other end of the spectrum, but it's sort of in the middle where it's like, if you go in there, you don't know what you're doing, you could hurt yourself at the worst. But at the minimum, at sort of the most common, is that people don't feel any better. Like, oh, I went in, I didn't feel good, didn't feel anything, and then I didn't do it again, right? Well, why did you go in? How many times did you go in? What pressure did you go in? Did anybody supervise you? Like all these kinds of things. Like, and oftentimes when I ask all those questions, like, oh, I don't have any answers to any of those questions. So changing human psychology, I don't have an answer for you. Maybe high dose psychedelics across the board. Like Timothy Leary back in the 60s, wanted to put LSD into the water supply in New York City.
Right.
That might be an interesting experiment. So other than sort of changing consciousness like that, you know, we have to meet people where they are, but try to give them a roadmap and kind of an understanding of like the triaging of their life and like what, and trying to be more methodical about what they do.
You know,
Dr. Scott, funny that you should, isn't it ironic that you should bring that up? We had a guest that talked about, it was all about, you know, post-traumatic stress, you know, in military and first responders. And, you know, he's using psychedelics as a solution, yeah, under medical, you know, supervision. You mentioned it. So now let's go down.
Well, actually before path. You bring that up, you know, I read the book that, How to Change Your Mind, you know, by Pollitt, yeah, great book, as well as The Obstacles in the Way. And he talks about Leary. So thank you for bringing that up. And you have like a little company called Synergistic Technologies, and it goes into some of that. So I'd like to know, because Wall Street Journal just came out with an article yesterday about how Silicon Valley is now running on psychedelics. And that was, and that literally was the title of the article. And it talks about Elon Musk using and all that. Now, my issue,
there you go.
Yes. Yeah, right. And my issue is people, again, with meth blue lozenges or psychedelics, they're going to go, oh, if Elon Musk or this guy's doing it, I'm just going to order some and find some and just take it in my living room. And there's a big difference between taking some in the living room versus taking it and having somebody walk you through these protocols, because you can alter your reality and now you don't really know what your reality is. So what's your thought processes on some of that?
I mean, it's a big topic. I mean, it's just, again, the nature of the human beast. Like I remember being involved in getting and doing some studies or doing some work with patients back in like 2014 and 15 on the ketogenic diet, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and cancer. Nobody could figure out how to do the ketogenic diet. It was only one organization that was doing it called the Charlie Foundation that's still around now that was working with children. And then, you know, 8 years later, I was going to conferences with keto cookies and ice cream and everything commoditized that you can imagine for keto. And that's what it is now, keto pizza or whatever. Like, that's just what we do as a commercialized company. And this is what happens with psychedelics. This is what happens with everything. I think the key really is to go back to the bases, to the basics of why these things work and what you're looking to achieve as a result of them. You know, the challenge with Silicon Valley and things is they're just looking for the ways to make more money, right? And to be more conscious, but this is really just creative. A spiritual ego that takes the place of their ego to try to get money. So it's like, it's not surprising. It's not something you can do anything about. It's just the way these cycles work, right? And so I think the key for me and for my companies, and so my companies that are making hyperbaric technologies, my company called OneBase, for example, OneBase Health, and then my company that makes methylene blue products called Triscriptions, is that what can we do here is that we can educate people, we can give them really great resources, we can give them really great technology, and then come out and talk about them and try to be something that I've tried to do for many years in the hyperbaric world is like be a voice of, I hope, reason and of balance and saying, not everybody should go into a chamber right now, right? It's not the right time for you. I've always said it's not if hyperbaric therapy will be helpful, it's when. I think everybody can benefit at some point, but maybe not right now, and maybe not for a long time, depending on what's going on. The same thing is the case with methylene blue, although I think there's more of a universal possibility for people to use it at low dose if people are using it in a intentional way. Same thing goes with psychedelics and with whether low dose or high dose. I think there is a significant education component, and I have a lot of friends in the space that are trying to do this. The good news is that most of them, especially at low dose, are going to be okay, but certainly at high dose, you can get into trouble and people can have bad trips. And this is not, you know, I have a podcast with my team called the Smarter, Not Harder podcast. And I interviewed one of my good friends. His name is Dr. Dave Rabin, who has a company called Apollo. And we talked significantly about what happens when psychedelics go wrong. And nobody talks about this. Like, what mm-hmm. do you do? How do you get help? And things like that. And he's really a great resource for all this. And so again, I don't have any like, you know, magical answers for you guys other than to say that you have to find the signal in the noise and find educational resources that you trust, find products that you trust that are tested, that are vetted by people that you trust, that are not just trying to sell you something all the time. You know, that I think that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Pardon my naivety, methylene blue, lozenges, what is it? What is it actually? And what does it do physiologically?
So we make something called a troche, which looks like a lozenge. It's a small dissolvable lozenge that goes between your upper cheek and gum, that dissolves there over about 15 to 30 minutes. It also can be swallowed as well. Methylene blue is fantastically bioavailable, which means it gets into the system very easily and readily. It's been around over 100 years. It was the first drug that was registered with the FDA back in the 1890s, actually, as an antimicrobial. And then over the last several decades, it's been studied in various types of models of mitochondrial dysfunction or cognitive dysfunction, ischemia, other things, because it helps with energy production in the mitochondria itself. It has multiple different roles. It has roles as increasing various neurotransmitters, including norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin, as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So it's a mild antidepressive. It's been used as an antidepressant in the past. It's been studied in bipolar disease with some success. It's being studied in models of Alzheimer's disease and cognitive impairment. But it's a drug that's been around a long time, so it's off patent. So you can't do a pharmaceutical drug with it. So the pharmaceutical companies have always looked at derivatives of methylene blue for various types of conditions, and they're doing that now in various trials. Our company is a direct-to-consumer company. We also sell to practitioners specifically as well. We have a professional line coming out specifically for practitioners. I do all the education, all the outreach for our practitioners. My father, he sells all our products at his office on Long Island as well, and has used a lot of methylene blue for the things we've been describing, as well as post-infectious conditions, COVID kinds of things as well, or similar kinds of processes with a lot of success overall. So it's kind of it's my utility player. Honestly, I use it for almost everything, but in the context of understanding what's going on.
So your dad's a chiropractor, yeah. You said earlier, and he is in Long Island, New York. Well, you're really far. You went to the other side of the map there. That's great to know, because I'm very interested in learning more about the methylene blue lozenges. So, well, that'll be another subject. But for now, we're going near the end, and we do this fun little part called rapid fire questions.
Cool.
I'm going to throw out a bunch of questions, four questions that you can, well, I always say, you know, give a quick answer, but it always ends up becoming something elaborate because it gets interesting. But if you're ready, I'm ready to throw out question number one.
I'm in. Let's do ready? It again.
Best book everyone you feel should read.
Best book. That's so hard. It's like there's different contexts of that, right? I think if you are a scientist or really interested in physiology, there's a book that I just finished. That's probably one of the best books that I've ever read. It's called Oxygen by Nick Lane. Nick Lane's written a bunch of books that are very, very interesting. He just came out with another one. I can't remember the name of it, but I want to read it soon. But basically, it's the story of oxygen and how it developed on the planet from an evolutionary perspective. And then it goes through the whole realm of how oxygen works and how our physiology is sort of, it's obviously dependent on oxygen, and all the positives and negatives or downsides of that, and how that manifests in disease and longevity and et cetera. So a really cool book. It was written in the early 2000s. I keep going back and reading parts of it because it's just so obvious I like looking at things from an evolutionary lens, in the sense of why are things the way they are physiologically? Like the most common thing, you know, as a chiropractor, you guys know this, and my father growing up, like, why do you have a fever, right? A fever is not there to give you Tylenol and ibuprofen. A fever is there to kill the bugs that are floating around, right? So that's the most common evolutionarily conserved way that we deal with infection, right? So, and there's various ways that we do this as a result of using oxygen to make energy. So I would highly recommend that to somebody that's a scientist that loves reading physiology and that wants to learn an evolutionary perspective.
Oh, love that. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. Really good. Thank you. Number two, best, you have a lot of theories that come up over time, and think of one that you felt was one of the craziest things that you went and you wanted to test to see if that theory was right.
It's a good question. I think I've been really interested in the work that I've been doing with Brian actually recently, because I will be honest, and I didn't really think of carbon dioxide as something I needed to pay attention to. I've been an oxygen guy, right? Because that's right. What I do.
Yeah.
But when I started talking to Brian and realizing how important carbon dioxide is to what I do, it's starting to become a lot more transformative in the work that I do with patients, and the work I do in the hyperbaric environment. You know, one of the biggest things is hyperventilation. You know, hyperventilation is going to shift something called your oxygen dissociation curve. So you're not going to dump oxygen into tissue. So why wasn't I having people do breathing exercises in the chamber to slow down their breathing, so they were not hyperventilating, so that the oxygen that I was giving them was actually going to work and do something other than just stay on your red blood cells and not dump off. So I've been really intrigued and excited to work with him and also some of my other colleagues in the worlds of CO2 and the worlds of hypoxia alongside hyperbaric oxygen therapy. I think there's a lot that's going on there. This is really sort of detailed and nuanced kind of work, but I think in the next several years, you're going to see a lot more of this from me, a lot more of this from Brian and others in this space.
Oh my gosh. I would love to just talk about that part. that is fantastically interesting. Okay. Question number three, though. To combat jet lag and maybe sharpen your mind after that, do you have a best tip for those travelers that are traveling such distances that would have jet lag?
Yeah, the easiest one is actually methylene blue. Methylene blue is a fantastic jet lag hack. If you go to transcriptions.com, our website, and just type in jet lag, we have a full protocol that we've developed that works swimmingly well. No matter the time zones, no matter how many time zones, I've been working with this for the last couple of years, and we finally published it. The reason why methylene blue works, because when you're traveling, you're getting more radiation exposure because you're obviously closer, you're off the surface of the planet. And so you get more radiation exposure from the sun. So it's a radiation protector. It also helps when you have lower oxygen on an airplane, you're typically pressurized to about 8,000 feet above sea level. So you have about 14 or 15% oxygen in the air. So you have methylene blue that helps protect you there from the stress of that, and also protects you because it helps you make more energy. It's also an antiviral and antimicrobial. So it helps with travel and preventing those kinds of things along the way. And it also obviously helps with energy. So you get off the plane, you don't feel like you just were hit by a bus, no matter how many time zones you went through. So that's my easy jet lag hack. You can just swallow the troches or the lozenges in a very prescribed way, and it works. So I'd highly recommend people look at that and check it out. Across the board, the response has been, you know, fantastic and overwhelming. The other hack that I use is obviously hyperbaric therapy. I mean, because if you are under, again, the same conditions, you're under low oxygen, radiation exposure, oxidative stress, and you go into a hyperbaric chamber afterwards, you're going to reverse a lot of that very quickly. So I have jet lag protocols that I've developed, like pre-treatment, so pre-flight and then post-flight. It's a really great way to kind of just get yourself oxygenated when you get off an airplane and feel much better much faster as well. But that's not obviously available to everybody. Getting methylene blue lozenges or the troches is pretty easy for most people. That's the easier of the two. I have a lot of other things that I do for jet lag, but I think that like those are my two go-tos because those are my wheelhouses, of course. You know, don't eat shit on the plane. Blue. Don't drink alcohol. Keep hydrated. Yeah. You know, don't try to get yourself on the time zone that you're going to be on as soon as you get on the plane. Those kinds of things too.
Is methylene blue good for all ages?
Yeah, it's been studied in and everybody. I mean, it's not good for pregnant women or breastfeeding women, but otherwise, yeah.
Okay. And this is not one of my questions, but how about hangovers?
So I haven't used it enough in hangovers to know yet. We're looking at it.
Terry will be happy to test himself.
What's that?
Terry, after his Axe and Whiskey night, he'd be happy to help you with it.
Yeah, you know, it's something we've looked at. There's another product that we have on our shelf, our electronic shelf on our store on the website called Blue Canatine. And that one's a combination of methylene blue with nicotine, caffeine, and CBD. So this is our nootropic, you know, full on nootropic. And this does help with hangovers, and it does help with jet lag too, if you're feeling a little rough as well. It's like taking Adderall without the jitters, really. So, or like more like a modafinil kind of feel if you've had that before.
Yeah. So. Oh, I love it. All right. My last question for you. What music do you listen to get yourself in the zone or in the flow state?
This has changed so much over the years, as you can imagine. I'm a guitarist. I've played guitar since I was 12. I was in bands when I was in high school and college and medical school. And I had a lot of fun doing all that. And so the music that I listened to that back during that time was very different than the music that I listen to now. My pump up music before a test in medical school was Led Zeppelin, probably. The music that I used to study to back in those days was a lot of just a lot of instrumental. My favorite of all time probably was Bela Fleck and the Fleckstones. Actually, he's a banjo player, been around for many, many years. Now I have this great app that I use. It's called Spotify. It's called Brain FM, brain.fm. And it's got, and you listen to it with headphones, and it's basically, it's music that is sort of optimized to help you focus. And they have various different types of things. There's study and reading. There's deep work, there's light work and things like that. So I tend to like that because it's background, but it's not too busy.
Is that similar to like binary rhythms or binary beats or Silvaccio rhythms and stuff like that?
Yeah, there's all these different things that people use, like binaural beats are something that I use sometimes. These guys don't have binaural beats, but they're sometimes I'll use something like that too. I'll go and just do some meditative kinds of work and then just be silent and do work too sometimes too.
That's awesome. I want to go back a little bit to the psychedelics. I know you're a hyperbaric chamber guy, but you know, taking out the money thing, taking all that, you know, psychedelics, I think were ruined in the early days from maybe political or whatever. And then now they're bringing this comeback, and I think they're extremely important to helping people with some brain traumas, especially our first responders and all that. But like with anything, as long as it's managed correctly, what's some of your thoughts on how to manage it versus just having a trip party? You know, how do you, where do you find is it John Hopkins? Where do you find the best protocols and where's your go-to place to learn some of that?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize that there are many people that I've worked with over the years that should have gotten better in a hyperbaric chamber. Everything said to me that this person should get better, but they didn't. And the reason almost always is psychological, in the sense that they have trauma, whether post-traumatic stress disorder, or they have thought loops that have been created as a result of being sick for a while, the sick loops, the trauma loops, all these things. So if you don't address those things, no matter how much hyperbaric therapy I give them, they will not get better. And so I learned this many years ago, and it's always something that's on my mind. And you can almost always tell when this person walks in the door because they've tried everything and nothing gets them better, right? They're on their last legs, and no matter what therapies they try, they work maybe for a short period of time or not at all, and they don't, and then they just stop working. And oftentimes what will happen is that, and this is not, it's said the incorrect way, I think, is that yes, in some ways it's all in your head, but in other ways, it's not like you don't have any control of it. You can do something about this, right? But our conventional ways of doing this, seeing a psychiatrist, taking an SSRI drug, are not going to work for the majority of these people, is in my experience. So this is where psychedelics come in. And I think they can be extremely effective in doing it, but it has to be done in an intentional way. So there's great resources out there for people. John Hopkins, as you said, is a great resource. They have their own psychedelic studies center there. Berkeley has one as well. There's a Center for Psychedelic Studies that's in San Francisco. There's MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. That's where I send most people, is the MAPS organization. Yes, you can find underground therapists doing MDMA and other kinds of therapies that are not above board yet. Thankfully, a lot of this stuff will become above board soon. I have a lot of people and a lot of friends in this space that are working very hard to do that. You're right, though. You don't want to just do these things without the proper supervision, with the proper care, with the proper integration. And again, that's probably the key is actually the integration piece, which is having people and having ways to integrate your experiences once you have these extreme shifts in your consciousness. And how do you put things back together in a more optimal way so that you can really optimize your neuroplasticity, right? That's the idea, is to change your brain and break those thought patterns. I mean, Paul Stamets always talks about his experience of being a stutterer when he was a kid, and then taking 25 grams of mushrooms accidentally, and his stuttering in a lightning storm went away and never came back.
Right.
Right. So you can change your patterns, you can change your neurophysiology, but it's not easy. And I don't recommend doing what Paul did, nor does he recommend anybody do it, but it's possible. But you know, having a process and the intention and a path with integration is really important.
I mean, that's kind of why I brought it up. I mean, you being in Colorado, me being in California, I have now patients that are growing their own asylum. You know, they're growing their own mushrooms. And I'm like, oh boy, you know, because now they're going to, and now they're slicing it up and they're taking it and they're reading something and they're reading a book and they maybe get halfway through it and they're like, oh, I got to take this. And I'm seeing some of the problems, but I've seen some incredible successes. I've seen some incredible successes with people with Asperger's that's been really helping them out. And I have a patient now taking that, and the problem is illegal. So they're trying to having a hard time finding these drugs and people that will do it. And yet the success when it's done right are phenomenal. And so, do you see that process changing where it's going to go from they're going to get off the Schedule One and they're going to make it better?
Yeah, it's already happening. And you have states like Oregon, states like Colorado that are creating whole regulatory frameworks for psilocybin, for example. So that it's all going to happen. It's just a matter of time. You're right that people have to be careful where they get their supplies from, especially if they're pills like MDMA or something like that. Those can be doctored, and you have to be super careful. Yeah.
That's so you are seeing the change and you know, how long do you think, I mean, that's a tough question, to get rid of the stigma of, it's LSD or, it's a psychedelics.
That's changed so much in the last decade already. I don't see that path stopping. I mean, certainly there's going to be people who do stupid shit. It's the nature of the human condition, as we've been describing. You can kill yourself on LSD if you run into traffic and you think you can stop it, right? So these are definitely ways that things are going to go bad when more people are using these things. It's just the nature of them, unfortunately. But I hope, and I think all of our hope in this world is that, and I'm almost positive this is going to be the case, the benefits are going to outweigh the risks. And I think you're going to see more and more regulatory framework, less criminalization, so more decriminalization across more states. I think the wave is now upon us, and there's going to be some people that don't do well across this, and there's going to be some collateral damage. But that's but I think overall it's going to be minimal compared to the positives.
Oh, Dr. Scott, I got to tell you, man, this was I absolutely loved this conversation. I kept feeling the impulse to ask branches of other questions. Yeah. And I really, really appreciate.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't just talk about hyperbaric therapy, guys. I could have just done that too if you wanted. So we can do that.
No, this is great. There's a lot of branches to health and wellness.
I'm
going to
blame you, Spencer, because you brought up methylene blue. And then we kind of went,
everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah.
I love it. Actually, when I'm going to order some when I get off from your dad. When I get off from
buy it online. You know? Buy it online.
But I kind of like this, or even to try and get into a subject in an hour is tough, because you can go 3 hours on these subjects and 5 hours and 6 hours. I think I kind of wanted to just touch a little bit of everything to hopefully entice people to dig more and to learn more. And I think if people get these foundations and it sparks something in their brain, then they will dig more and turn to you for, hopefully you get a couple of emails or a couple thought processes and Brian gets some. I mean, if we can expose good thought processes and intrigue people to dig more and have conversations with people and take their help seriously. So,
I think just to that end, I would say that, my practice is all, pretty much virtual. I consult with people all over the world that are interested in hyperbaric therapy. During those conversations, 85% of what I talk about is not hyperbaric therapy, as I already discussed. That's my surprise for people. But I mean, I think that's the idea. So I work with clinics, I work with individuals, I work with clinicians that are looking to get trained in hyperbaric therapy. My specialty is the integration of hyperbaric therapy with other tools, technologies, and practices. And so it's not just about getting to the chamber. And oftentimes it's not about getting to the chamber right away, as we've been discussing. Then I also have my company, Troscriptions, the word prescription, but with a T-R-O in front of it, Troscriptions. That's the company that makes the buccal troches, the lozenges that you've been describing, the one for methylene blue, their stack, which is for more focus, or Adderall equivalent, which is called Blucanatine. And we have a nonprofit organization attached to that company as training doctors called Health Optimization Medicine and Practice. So for chiropractors out there, they're looking for a framework. I think it's a fantastic one that is pretty... it's pretty different from what's out there. It's not focused on disease. It's focused on health. So it's more in the line of how I grew up, the son of a chiropractor, and optimizing for health rather than disease, et cetera. So you can check that out at homehope.org and transcriptions.com. And my personal website is either my name, drscottshure.com, or integrativehbot.com will also get you there too.
You know what? On that note, thank you so much. And I'll put all that stuff in your description so they can have links to everything.
Yeah.
So... Scott, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy man, but I appreciate your time talking to us, and we appreciate all your knowledge and all of the ways of you're doing to help people. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, guys. It's been fun.
Thanks, Dr. Scott. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Crackin' Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Crackin' Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.